today, I thought, because of my own expertise and the work I've been doing now for a long, long time in some capacity on behalf of schools, and in the last 5 years as a principal lobbyist for private elementary and secondary schools, it might be interesting to explore how an idea becomes a law, and I have some materials to do that, because that's the work of a lobbyist in Washington, D.C. year-round, in Oregon every other year for as long as the legislature meets. They meet every other year, and I would do some work in Oregon, and the Washington State Legislature, which meets 60 days on alternate years, 120 days on the other year. So, and it's a very interesting job to try and strategize how you're going to take an idea and put it into action, and it is not very easy. So I'll give you some of the tools and some of the processes, and then we'll certainly have time for questions too. I'll try and keep from that. The other session I did, the other area I wanted to discuss, and would hope to do that on Saturday morning, relates to some of the Supreme Court issues and maybe some of the personalities in the political world today, if it's possible to get to that, and the impact that they will have in a very short time in terms of political campaigns emerging in the next 2 years, and that should have quite an effect in our country. So I've tried to take a little bit of an outline. First of all, the issues, maybe some of the terms, preparing a bill and how do you get it introduced, testifying before the legislature and some of the strategies, and do that in a sufficient amount of time so that you can raise also some issues that you might have and how those are accomplished. So far, in our sessions here, in terms of both the morning devotions, which I thoroughly enjoy, and the evening vespers, some of the issues that I think are important have been raised, and some of those that are considered at the local, state, and national level to be very, very important, certainly not least of all the international level. But we did start, certainly, with some of our lessons dealing with the poor and oppressed peoples. And in that area, we can raise then a number of issues that, in my mind, relate to education in schools, food, and this morning we dealt in our lessons in terms of the items even that relate to hunger, the Lord feeding the 5,000, and then dealing with the woman brought before Jesus in adultery before the scribes and the Pharisees. And then that led us into thinking about the people that with AIDS and how do we treat someone who is a victim of the sin in our society or the evil in our society. Certainly jobs, and then the whole realm of health and medical, which is a critical concern of the poor and the needy, as well as others. Our friend Alden Bryant next door is dealing with the issues of environment relating to climate, forest, soils, and jobs, and every one of these I've named will have some committee in the legislature or Congress dealing with those issues, and they will have a host, an array of lobbyists surrounding them, special interest groups, PACs, who are politically active organizations who lobby in large groups, and you hear the term PAC money, both at the state and national level, raising vast sums of money to put into campaigns and to influence the way elections or the way legislation would go. And I want to also discuss both the positive and the negative aspects of that. Certainly the issue, I think, of schools and teachers have been a foremost topic throughout the United States. Every state in the union is discussing the role of our schools. Yesterday I was presenting on the topic the Constitution as a living document. And some of the young people here, a couple of young people commented that really out of school, they had a very limited education and understanding of the basic rudiments and elements of our Constitution and how it was developed. I really feel that if you're going to be involved in the legislative process, if you're going to be involved in making changes, you really have to have a good knowledge of the United States Constitution as well as the state constitution in the state, particularly where you work, if you're going to affect change. You have to know the constitutional limits that you have as well as the possibilities. So in the area where that has been very controversial in terms of what is the role of schools in our country, in our society, and of course as a schoolman, I can't think of really anything more important than getting a basic education and becoming literate in those areas so you can understand the elements of citizenship and responsibility to vote. One of our problems in our society is that few people vote, really, from a percentage standpoint. The fourth area that I feel has come up, too, is in terms of a good deal of discussion on quality of life and dealing with values and matters that relate to individual self-esteem. And then the one we dealt with yesterday, the question I dealt with that was raised was a whole aspect of the balance between the judicial, the legislative, and the executive. I'm convinced in my own mind that the Constitution does provide the elements and the ability for amendment and change, and the Congress as a legislative branch, which was given substantial authority by the founding of fathers, can make those changes. My feeling at times is that people at that level frequently, because of pressures and special interests, do not, and the desire to be reelected, some just do not have the real guts to deal with the issues that are there, and that the political elements, the parties, become so polarized that if this person, a very intelligent, bright person, takes one side of the issue, the tendency is, well, how do I argue with the other side? The president has his five-minute radio broadcast, and the other side presents the other opinion out of fairness, which I think is important, too. But the tendency sometimes is to polarize rather than to come to agreement. In the original writing of the Constitution and founding of our country, I think people felt that the Senate was to be kind of with the longer terms, would be that group that would come to more larger discussions about the issues that affect the country, and probably the House of Representatives, elected every 2 years, would deal with much shorter term answers and probably with more frequency. Some people are recommending that the congressman, that term be extended to 4 years, just because of the fantastic expense associated with it. There is an initiative in the state of Washington that will go to initiative that will go to the people in the state of Washington in November that would call for increased terms for members of the House of Representatives. I believe that was passed. I hope I'm correct on that. Well, anyway, lobbyists also have a place in Olympia. They talk about the House, the Senate, as the one of the houses of the legislature, and then the House of Representatives, another house, and they talk about the third house. The third house is that core of lobbyists that walk between the two in a place in Olympia's Ulster Gulch. So that the guys worrying between the two houses to see what will happen, whether or not their bill is going to be passed. Now, what I did today, and I have more. These are some bills that came out. You just take one. I have to use the state of Washington because because of the fact I'm most familiar with that. The one thing that's interesting about all of the states in the Union, when our founding fathers set a bicameral legislative system, the Senate and the House, and there were tremendous debates on how those people should be represented. And in the, I talked just a little bit about the New Jersey plan and the Virginia plan. The New Jersey plan was really to just amplify and correct the Articles of Confederation. And those from Virginia, and Virginians had a good delegation under the Virginia plan, wanted to set up just rewrite the whole system and adopt a new constitution, which has subsequently happened. But in that plan, they wanted representation in the Senate on the basis of population. And so finally, in the hammering out of the agreements, why you had two senators from each state, and the House was based on population. Now, when you're working, if you have an idea, somewhere or another, you have to get it in some kind of writing. And some people spend a lot of money hiring lawyers and people to draft bills for the legislature. If you'll notice on that bill, you'll see that everyone is passed on to a committee. And some of them say passed on to rules, and some are adopted, and some are never passed the legislature. If it passed the legislature, you'll see a cover sheet that shows that it's signed by the Secretary of both houses, and you'll see concurrence and all kinds of things related to a bill. But to start with, you have to draft the bill and state what you want to accomplish in your piece of legislation. If it's appropriation for schools, if it has something to do with environment, you have to make sure it's in the proper language. And then generally when you present it, it will always be referring to legislation that already exists. Now, the other key in the political process is you have your bill prepared, you may have your organization said, fine, friends, you're on the way. Then you have to find someone to introduce it into the legislature, to put it onto the floor. And that's true whether it's the United States Congress or Washington, Oregon, or any other place. They will draft them in different forms. This happens to be the way Washington does it. Now, moving a little bit to strategy on introducing a bill, you have to face the reality of majority and minority parties, and you have to face the realities of that balance. In the state of Washington last year, in the Senate, we had 25 Democratic senators and 24 Republicans. In the House, it was much overbalanced, which also creates a problem. It was, seems to me, it was 60-some to 38 or something in that area. There are 98 members of the House in Washington. Sometimes the overbalance of power has some real disadvantages for that majority party, too, because of the fact then the party in power, people in that area, can vote more on their own conscience rather than on the caucus conscience. So you can get some interesting play there. Now, generally speaking, for a lobbyist, I've found that it's more practical for me to be a nonpartisan lobbyist, because you have to work both sides of the aisle, first of all. As we say, both sides of the aisle, because there's an aisle down the middle, the Republicans on one side, the Democrats on the other in our system. So generally speaking, generally, and almost usually, at least in our situation, most legislators, You introduce a bill with the majority party if you can do that, because they control all the chairmanships. In Olympia, for instance, we have a Democratic governor, Ruth Gardner. We have a Democratic Senate, very close margin, and a Democratic House. That should be easy, but he had no end of difficulty last year trying to get something through the legislature. I found, too, that over the years, as I've worked with it, there is an underlying common sense that seems to emerge. In other words, there is some impact on the part of the people. I guess the reason I'm presenting this series during this time at Holden is because we have a chance to sit here and talk to one another without quite so much bias, and discuss issues rather openly. And I really wanted to come here essentially to encourage people to use the legislative process. You can talk and deal with issues, but until you get actively engaged into it, you can't affect the change you want. And it seems very frustrating at times, but there's no question that legislators respond to personal input. They don't like a mass letter that's mimeographed and someone signs it and they get it. It's just one of another, but a personal letter, a personal contact, a visit, they very definitely respond, whether it's congressional, the United States, or the state level. But anyway, you generally introduce, if you want to have a bill read and heard before the committee, you generally deal with the majority party chairman. In my case, I essentially deal with the House Education Committee and the Senate Education Committee. And so I'm going to work through that chairman. So that, and oftentimes they do not have to introduce the bill on the floor of the legislature, but eventually you're going to have to deal with it. So once that bill is introduced, and I did also bring some handouts on how a bill becomes a law, and you might be interested in looking at that, because that again, I think you'll find to be a very similar process. Are any of you here legislators or work in the legislative process? And essentially, the pattern will be the same. There's only one unicameral legislature in the United States. You know which one that is? Nebraska. Is someone from Nebraska? Are you from Nebraska? That's correct. Nebraska is the only state that has the unicameral legislature. So in that case, it would still be the same thing. You're still going to introduce a bill. Committees are going to hear it. What makes Nebraska a little easier, of course, is you're not having to deal with two houses. And I can tell you from experience, it's just like in the Congress of the United States. It's easier to work the Senate than the House. Because in the Senate, you're dealing with 100, and the House, you're dealing with nearly 500. Same as state of legislature, it's easier to deal with.
Can you explain this a little bit, why Nebraska is different?
Well, it's just that they chose not to go according, in a sense, to the constitutional model that was laid out by the United States. I'm trying to remember when they were accepted in the Union. It was somewhere in the, in that later part of their history. I mean, it wasn't as late as Washington, and probably about the time of Oregon, but they chose to just go with a unicameral legislature because it might have been the population too. You go to Alaska, I've been in Alaska, and they have 20 representatives and 10 senators. In Oregon, they have 60 representatives, 30 senators, Washington
98.
I don't know what the number is, But it's less. It's easier to work with. I think it was efficiency. I think Nebraska, the only state in the Union a long time, had to claim they had no debt. They were free and clear of debt. But it's just more effective. But democracy is not efficient. But Nebraska is more efficient than others because they've cut down the parts you have to go through.
May I ask another question?
Yes.
How about Louisiana with the parishes there? Isn't that different?
Slightly different. Correct. It's an interesting concept because it's a church. It's a church model. In fact, I discussed a bit the other day. It's in Louisiana, of course, that you had the decision, this U.S. Supreme Court decision on creation, science, and evolution. And it's interesting that would come out of that. I mean, it is not surprising. It is interesting that it came out of the state of Louisiana. Any other comments in that area? Once that committee gets that bill, you can see, then you have the process. You're constantly having to work there. That's why lobbyists never leave Olympia, and that's why they never leave Washington, D.C. You have to constantly baby that bill through if it's going to go anywhere. Because not only now you have it on the floor of the legislature, they refer it then to a committee, and you'll see in some of those bills, they've referred it to a committee. The committee then has to hold hearings. And that depends on which side. Now, sometimes the strategy, you'll introduce the bill in the same language on both sides. So if you can't work the Senate, you work the House and so forth. That's to give you protection, in a sense. Most of them work that. The committee that has to, now you have to get the chairman of the committee to say, I'm going to schedule a hearing. You've got to work that part and make sure the committee and the staff are aware of what you want to accomplish in that legislature. And then I want to say something about staff. Staff can be very critical. We had one of the people sitting in a couple of sessions was a staff and legislative aide in Olympia. And she's also run some campaigns for candidates. But staff can be very important because sometimes you can take care of all of your detail work through the staff because they are going to make sure that that legislator hears that. So if you go to the legislature, go to Congress, you can't get to the congressman, you're offended, or the senator or the representative offended by that. Don't be, because if you talk to the staff frequently, you've accomplished as much because they feel an absolute obligation that that item that you bring them has to be discussed with the legislator. It's only when you're dealing with, I'd say, with the some elements of pressure that you want to bear on an issue, then you may want to do something in terms of the legislator. The one thing I do is that they have a whole lot of caucus parties. You know, I usually try and attend the four caucus parties of the legislature. That's the only thing our organization can afford, frankly, but it's some legislators down there, you can see why the vast sums of money come up, because every caucus and every party that's held, and those of you who've contributed to political campaigns know what's involved. We're talking about $50, $100, $500, $1,000 to carry on campaigns. It's expensive. That's the way we do it. I'm not sure that's not an area where we don't need to examine for change, but when you start to limit that process and you introduce some other factors that aren't so good. So the committee now has your bill, and now you're going to hear the bill. I brought a few little things on how to testify before the Washington State Legislature, which I think probably would be about the same as any other place, and just some little keys. When you're in almost any dealing with them, I can tell you that the last session of the Washington State Legislature, there were 2,000 bills introduced. I brought a little stack. And when you get the amendments, it's like this, you know, that's in the state of Washington. I can imagine what it is when you start adding 50 states and add some state like New York or Illinois or Ohio or Pennsylvania, you know, those the large states in the union. You can imagine what type of legislative paper flow there is in that process. And then if they make an amendment, write a new one. You know, you got to make sure all of those corrections are made. Now you've got it to the committee. You've now testified before the committee. The committee has to decide. Yeah, yes.
There's just a little gap there. I want to know, how do you get to testify before a committee? How do you make that known, or do you get invited, or what about
your
time?
Both. And use it. I can remember one of those bills a couple of my friends had, which I was not sponsoring. I'll just give you an example of how fast sometimes I can be or how long. If you're sponsoring a bill, your organization is working on it, then you're dealing with this chairman, and you're going to work with him as to when that bill is put on the agenda. The committees will meet two or three times a week. Then you will sign in, sometimes ahead and sometimes when you walk into the room. Generally, the staff and everyone will know that you're going to be. However, I had a little situation in the last legislature. We had in the private fundamentalist Christian community, wanted to introduce a bill related to teacher certification. Again, I can cite more of the education examples than I can of some of the others, but this was to amend the law. It doesn't have a chance. I mean, I can predict now with the number of years of experience almost what can go at a certain time and what can't go. I think I can predict to some extent how the Supreme Court of the state of Washington will act on an issue, and a little degree on how the United States Supreme Court will act based on the personalities. That's the other thing you do. You have to study the people in there. Lobbyists spend some time in just knowing who the people are and how they think and what they represent. So you kind of just pitch it. But on the testifying, you come in, sign up, and use, in our state, we put pro or con, and whether you're representing yourself or some organization. Now that's done different ways in different states. That's how it's done in Washington and Oregon. And I've been dealing a little bit with Alden on some issues he's talking about in California. And Alaska, I know a little bit about. And Idaho, I'm not telling you something. But, so that's how you get there. And you have to be bold about that. But this issue came up on the agenda one day without the knowledge of people who were very interested. So I called them and said, they're going to be bringing this bill up. Come up. There they were in the morning at 8 a.m. from some part of the state and testified and gave very excellent testimony on the bill, even though it did not go anywhere. So now you've testified. Then the committee listens, asks questions, sometimes not too pleasant, depending on the nature of the chairman and the members. And you're challenged to defend your position. And I say generally, be brief, to the point, and then be ready to take on. But then you have people testifying against you. You know, you have the con. That's tough. Now, once they've heard it, then the committee has, in our state, has an executive session. Frequently, I think that's often true. They hear it, listen, discuss it, then they have executive session, which is open. The public can hear what that session is. Then you have to have their votes, the committee. So when I work a committee where I have a House Education Committee, I passed everything through the Senate, went to the House Education Committee on a bill that our we were interested in my group. 21 members on. I had to count those votes. And I got to 11 to 10 on my bill. And the 11th vote, the yes vote, took a walk. And I lost my bill right at the end. Now those are the frustrations of the process. However, if the committee passes that bill, now you can tell on the basis of that committee vote what your chances are out in that main session. At 11-10 vote, not hopeful out there, although sometimes it happens. Then that goes, they vote out. If positive, they pass it on generally to the Committee on Rules. Rules then is a powerful committee. Now you have to get it through the rules. You got it through this one spot. Now you've got to go to the Rules Committee and count those votes sometimes, although it's a little easier in the state of Washington rules than it is in the state of Oregon, or in some other state. You've got now you've got to do that. It goes then to the floor. Now you got to worry about the argument on the floor. That's true in the United States Congress too.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Committee on Rules? I mean, I'm really interested in the whole process. Do they then establish the agenda for the legislature?
They establish
what bills they're going to take a look
correct.
At and what
that's
order
right.
priority and so
that's right.
Okay.
Now they establish, then once that bill goes to Committee on Rules, they're sitting on, that's a powerful committee, balanced again by the number of Democrats and Republicans by their majority or minority. They sit around and develop a list, and there in some states why they use different sheets on priority. Then that they establish they don't exactly establish that agenda because usually it's the staff or the clerk working with the speaker or the president determines the order. And they'll change that even when it gets to the floor. They'll change the rules or suspend the rules. See, I brought along a little manual to kind of look at that. This is a legislative manual, the state of Washington. This tells you what it goes. You have the United States Constitution, the state constitution, the rules and regulations, and so forth. That's a good point. Now, the Rules Committee now meeting, they've decided whether they will pass it out of rules. They say it's passed out of rules in some legislatures for third reading, second reading, they move them from the different levels until it's then up on the agenda for discussion and adoption. They can suspend the rules and move that depending on the rules of the legislature. But may, that rule, rules committee may be different in different states, so I'll explain that to the Washington State case.
Have you lost your personal input by this time?
No. No, no. You're sitting on the rules committee, because you also have to get a, you have to get in Washington, you have to get someone to pull that bill. They call it pulling the bill. Now, once you've got it to the committee, then you go to rules, then you get someone to pull that bill for you. Then you have to have a majority vote of that committee. You're following every step all the way. And you can see now if a lobbyist has several interests, and now you can see why lobbyists get up into handling several clients. We had a report in Washington what lobbyists were paid, and in Washington, D.C., what they paid. And you can see why lobbyists really have a very heavy job. I see the guys down there dealing with the nursing home interests or convalescent centers, or dealing with oil interests, or dealing with bankers, or dealing with the doctors, the lawyers, the chiropractors, the trial lawyers, the teachers, and so forth and so on. It gets to be a very strong fight going on to make sure you're issuing merchants. And that's why these, then you have the opposition saying, don't pull the bill. A senator in the rules committee will say, I want to, they'll have, say, three to five pulls, depending on how early the session is. And then at some time they'll suspend everything except, say, financial issues, fiscal issues, which are the tough ones. But they can name and say, I want Senate bill. This has been, this was pulled. So I want the House Bill 403 to come up on the agenda, pulled. Pulled out of the stack of 2,000 bills and say this goes on the agenda.
And if the bill is not pulled, it never makes
dies.
Time. It just dies. And can it has die. To start all over again
no,
next year? Or?
Yeah. Unless you, but the strategy will be, as we say, until sine die, until that final gavel falls, there's a chance. Because then I'll tell you what happens if you don't make it through the, if you don't get through the committee or the rules, then you'll hear about hanging, the hanging on to bills. Christmas tree, they talk about Christmas tree bills in the United States Congress or state legislatures. The Christmas tree is when everybody hangs on their bill. Because once you've gotten past this, now we're on to the floor of one of the houses. And then you've got to fight that through. You may have to count every vote. You may have to go around as you think, yes, no, maybe, yes, no. If it's a tight bill. Now, there's some that are not. Some are just like that. They have to go through it. But if it's a controversial issue, those guys are down there counting votes. They're sending notes into the legislature. And finally, then it's on the agenda. They act on that bill. Then, so now it's gone through that house. And they transfer it to the other side. You start all over. You start all over on the other side. It goes to that. If it's in the Senate Education Committee and it's passed, it's going to the House Education on the Committee, House Education on the other side to do the same thing. That starts the same process. So it can die anywhere in that process. And if it dies anywhere in that process, then you're fighting to see, can you hang it on? But if you hang it on, most the Congress, and it'll have to have what is called scope and purpose. It will still, you can't just hang it on, you can't hang an education bill onto an energy bill necessarily. It'll have to have the same scope and purpose. The Congress has a little different rulemaking, and so you'll find in Congress they hang some interesting things on the basis of either a senator or a representative specialty. Well, the one example, probably the most controversial example in the last in the United States Congress was hanging on the aid for the Congress. In other words, you take a big budget bill of $900 billion and hidden it. That's what always irritated me a great deal about money as far as the Congress is concerned. At least in the budget making process or the revenue process, particular budget making process. You get a $900 billion bill. Now, they have various spaces that are, you know, split, and you can imagine what it is. But hidden, not hidden in there. But the president doesn't have item veto. That he's been asking for that. And I have felt for a long time that's not a bad idea. In the state of Washington, that's not true in every state. Our governor can veto on an item and pass the rest of it. But that's not true for the president at the national level. Therefore, they have a bill, $900 billion, and they have $3 billion for a particularly important program, and buried in that is $100 million aid to the Contras. Then you bargain as to whether or not you're going to lose, you know, you're going to throw out the baby with the bathwater.
How does it get hidden in there?
It's not really hidden, it's there.
And what process has to be undergone?
Well, the committee has to deal with that. The budget, the committee's doing the budget, and the president is having his people up there working and making sure that item is in there. Of course, the Congress.
Is that tagging it on?
It's not really tagging it on. It's probably done in the budget process, and then they take it out. See, that was taken out. I think it was taken out. I can't remember the details of it. But we do know that that was eventually taken out, and that's how the executive got in so much trouble by their own design, essentially, because they decided they were going to do it another way. It's quite an interesting debate on the constitutional powers of the president to do that, and that's why these hearings are quite fascinating in that area.
The line veto seems like such a sensible idea. What are the main objections?
Well, because you have President Reagan who would veto out, I mean, you have the Democratic Party concerned that the president would veto out those things that are particularly important to them, or the other way around. I mean, whether it's a Democratic president and so forth. Now, at the state level, it's not as significant as at the national level.
Well, it scares me to death the line that.
Well, it does. That's why they're not doing it.
I agree.
Because that's correct. That's right. And that's why it's not going to happen.
Then it requires 528 brains or whatever the total number is.
526 or 528.
You know, put together, certainly should have more input and value than one.
And that's what our founding fathers believed. That's why it hasn't been done. And I don't think it will be done. In fact, my hope is that there will be the legislative will move more strongly to consolidate its constitutional power that's already been given. Because I think we can rely on our people. Jim?
I think one thing I have to keep in mind, too, is that those 500 and some brains all have to be reelected.
That's also another problem.
They pass some very interesting legislation.
You have to deal with it. There's a different scriptural warrant for against the line item veto. I think it would probably
That's a very good comment on this at this point.
There was another thing I wanted to bring up. Hanging on a bill with a 65 mile an hour speed limit was hung on to this other bill, the federal highway bill.
That's right.
What you mean?
Yeah, that kind of thing. Right. They'll bring it. They bring it in at a certain point.
And it really doesn't have too much to do with it.
No. And Congress, you can do some, they have a little more leeway than we do at, say, in the Washington State Legislature. I know there has to be scope and purpose, and I know that. That limits what you can do.
Carl, I'm interested in how an item like that is hung on another bill. Is it one committee member in the hearing committee, or is it a majority of the committee?
It has to be a legislator. He can do that on the floor.
Oh, on the floor itself?
He could. That's what you do. Is if I tried to hang a couple of items on a couple of years ago. It didn't work, but because it doesn't work that frequently, because once they've decided what they want, hanging on an item to destroy the bill, if they think they have it going, you have to hang it on something that's so solid, and then you have to have someone do it. But a legislator can go in and he introduces an amendment, a floor amendment.
That requires majority vote again.
Oh yes. You'd have to have your majority on that. In certain areas, you have to have your 2/3. Yeah, you'd have to amend it. It can't just be put on there. It has to have a majority of the sitting body in the Senate or House. Very good.
When they talk about that very high rate, president said there was so much fasting. Now, I have an idea what he means, but could you explain a little better? Maybe fat to him may not be fat to 100,000 people.
Yeah, I'm not sure what I remember the details of that bill, frankly, at the United States level. Can you cite what the bill?
I can't cite other than this, that the Democrats said it was providing jobs for I don't know how many people, but many, many people.
Yeah, that was the reason they could tie it on there, because they bargained against the millions and millions of dollars going out to states against the removal of the 65-mile-per-hour limit. I remember that. That comes back to me.
And then he called it fat, you know, and the man from Ohio said,
and they overrode the veto.
A popular gun fat.
And then he overrode that. The other thing I think occasionally in Congress too, at the United States Congress level, I find they will have some tremendous debates over a $50 million or $100 million item in terms of savings, and they, you know, that is spread through the news so vigorously. You know, I wish they'd deal with the $200 billion deficit, I really, not that $100 million isn't a lot of money, but it's compared to the $900 billion or the trillion. It's not a drop in the bucket, but it is not as significant. I wish they'd argue a lot more about the deficit, which I think is going to strap us so heavily down the years.
Could you say a word about the tremendous deficit we've got?
I'm not a great expert on economic or financial matters. Only to comment that it does appear that there will be less expenditure in the next year. That they're hoping to reduce it down to maybe 140. I think it's 140, $150 billion we're talking about. The budget making power and the control of that, I believe, rests with the Congress. And not that I don't have criticism of the president in what I think are the tremendous expenditures for military hardware and for military purposes. Nonetheless, I think that power exists in the legislative branch to control that. And now, to deal sometimes with the national policy, the way the executive or the legislative sees it is a little bit of a problem. We almost have to deal with that in our own way. In Washington, for instance, in Washington State, we had two senators, Magnuson and Jackson, now departed, who were very, particularly Senator Jackson, a strong proponent of defense expenditures. And of course, we're just rimmed with military bases here in the state of Washington. And every time that you deal with those kinds of issues of military, it always says, you know, what is it going to do to me or to my community and so forth. And I think that has been one of our real concerns. I think that's a concern we're dealing with it that Holden. Now, we may have different opinions about how it ought to be done, but I think we're all concerned about the so-called, we put that economics is a kind of back of our problems that relate to the poor and the oppressed and so forth. And I believe it goes back even farther than that. For the last 50 years, we've had kind of an economy that went up and down based on the military and military expenditures. And that creates our jobs and creates a lot of economic factors that are inimical to our better feelings and our concern for others.
Isn't that exacerbated by the international debt and security? Our own national debt.
Yeah, and then how do we produce, you know, the other economic aspect of it is, how do we produce enough capital? I mean, there has to be a production of capital and goods to pay for these things. I mean, we may have to look at our monetary system in a completely different way. The other thing, if you look at who the $200 billion is owed to. Generally speaking, it's owed to us. We can sometimes become abstract about those kinds of things, but if you look at the debt, it's owed in certificates and bonds and all kinds of banks, substantially banks, I think, if we look at where it is. Now, I'm not sure what's happened someday if the president came and said, all is forgiven. Or we all say to the government, say, friends, you know, it's no good. Therefore, you take my bonds and my bank or my municipal bonds and give them away. In a sense, that's what happened in the whoops thing. Mm-hmm. People lost hundreds of thousands of dollars in this whoops deal. Well, that was government debt in a sense. We owed it to them. Yes. I think that the crisis is. I might be well someday to have an economist come in here and maybe spend some time. I think it'd be really good to have maybe that's what we need now, because so much has been mentioned of economics here in the last few days that I've been here. It might be interesting to have an economist or two come explore that from an international military standpoint, because we talk about the military industrial governmental complex, and I still come back that those factors are so difficult, because then you can start comparing our ability and our to produce the resources we have against the percent of national product. And I don't know those figures, but there are some elements that relate to that. In other words, I don't believe, other than my moving back to foreign policy, I think we'd have to conclude any military expenditure is a terrible waste of money and resource. I think we'd all conclude that. But then we move to some other higher considerations of why certain things are done in this kind of mixed up world. We need to move. Scott Peck, I've been reading a little of Scott Peck, The Different Drum, a bit, and he has such unusual moves to transform what we're doing that I don't see it, but at least his concept and his ideas and his thoughts are very likely in the right direction. We need such a major transcendence of what we're doing and transformation of what we're doing. I believe that would be one of the things we need to say about, as Christians, we still have to be very, very active and dynamic in raising those questions and resisting where we feel in our conscience it's inappropriate. Probably the best example that we have in the state of Washington, and I think the best example I know, is our Archbishop in Seattle, Archbishop Harnhausen, who has, you know, put his name on the line. Another one is Jonathan Nelson, a Lutheran pastor in Seattle. I don't see myself, in a sense, going and climbing over the fences of Trident or laying down on the track in front of the trains coming in, but you look at people like that, and they are a witness to our conscience constantly in those areas. The Archbishop withholds part of his income from his taxes, and he announced that at Pacific Lutheran University, the meeting of pastors, I think. Muller and DiRicci on capitalism, communism, and Christianity. Good.
And the theology of man. And the life of freedom by communism and Christianity.
Is there, in essence, a substance of what they were attempting to do in the comparison?
They dealt a lot with the economics
is a fascinating study in that whole area, Jim.
Going back to your model here, number five strategies, I think that anybody who wants to introduce a bill needs to keep in mind the strategy of money, because I've seen in the nursing home industry where we've had to jerk a few of our bills because we realized there wasn't going to be the funds, and the bill can be chopped up so much that it was going to be detrimental.
Yeah, that's true, too.
Especially in this state here, you need to look at your local legislators to see where they have their revenue. whether it's a revenue that's growing or a revenue that's diminishing.
That's very true. Yeah, very key.
I think the next step beyond getting legislation passed is the regulation writing process.
Oh.
And who, you know, because I'm involved in writing interpretive regs and that type of thing.
Where do you, what is your...
I work for Homeland Security.
Oh, I see. The state, yeah.
And so, I mean, that's part of my job is I take the law and I say, what does it say?
Right.
And write it down so that people understand it. Or, you know, interpret, you know, what particular phrase in the legislation says.
There's a cartoon that shows Moses coming down from the mountaintop. Have you seen that cartoon with the two tablets of the Ten Commandments? And the next thing shows an absolute rock pile of rules and regulations to carry them out. Well, I think, yes, I'd want to go back now because here, you know, I worked in government a good portion of my life. I worked for the public schools and I worked for the state superintendent as you worked for employment security. You know, I know a lot of wonderful Christian people in the legislature and in the Congress. I think of my own congressman, Norm Dix, is a Lutheran from Bremerton, and the newly elected Supreme Court Justice is William Rehnquist, a Lutheran, and they're worshiping around the Capitol. I do think we have to remember that we have, you know, many wonderful Christian men in the legislatures of our country, in the Congress. We can't forget that. But we also have to call them to conscience too, as all of us need to be at Holden. And what are we going to do better when we activate that which we discuss in a setting like this? And I wouldn't want to put that down. The other thing I would like to say is that taking all the systems in the world that I've seen or visited with what I consider to be certainly my limited knowledge, I would have to say I don't believe there's anything better than what we have in America in terms of a system of government. It's still a system, a government of laws. Nor do I find any economic system that could provide the vast, vast resources, because someone out there is working and producing some kind of profit or some type of difference between what it costs and some profit. I think of what we support through our efforts, and I look at what kinds of things happen in our country, goodness of our country, going back to one of the most, you know, the Marshall Plan and the Peace Corps and the way we send money and lend money to virtually everybody in the world at our own, to our own difficult times. That doesn't mean we're doing everything right, and that's, I guess, why I call a Christian to political activism and our churches and our people to that, because we have a responsibility in my mind to be responsible for that which is right or wrong as our conscience is. I think if I really have a concern coming from an educational standpoint is our ability to really know and understand. I feel we're developing an increasing number of our young people who are not as literate as they ought to be verbally, numerically, morally, ethically, spiritually, economically, vocationally. I mean, a whole range of areas that in my mind we have to look at in terms of balance. And I would have a tendency to reprioritize our expenditures to concentrate on that, but then I think we need to do a lot of transformation and restructuring of the way we deliver educational services. Now, I'm not here to solve that problem today, although I did talk a little bit about doing four or five in that range of series of looking at our educational system in terms of structure and our responsibility as Christians to that.